Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Okalski.
Our theme today is unintended helpful Samaritans. I almost changed it mid-title.
Okay. I know.
And we are here broadcasting from enlightenradio.org in Bolivar, West Virginia, and Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. We are such a cosmopolitan group. Provincial.
A die state thing.
Say that.
Die as in DI. Two states.
Say that again.
A die state, or bipolar, like by state, two states,
tri-state.
West Virginia.
Yes, we are by state.
Yeah, West Virginia and Maryland, there's only two.
I live at the cusp of the quad state, so I get confused.
Okay.
I live near the intersection of Route 7, I-70, and Interstate 81. So... I call it the quad state. I worked for 20 years for an organization that talked about the quad state all the time.
And what are the four states?
Well, it depends on how you're counting, but Pennsylvania and Virginia are a stone's throw from me.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's four.
Yeah. Okay. But okay.
Today is August 1st, 2022, and we might need to wake up.
There you go. Rabbit.
We're happy we have some listeners and that we're starting a brand new month, rabbit. And we have stories for you. How was your weekend, Mr. Z?
Oh, I had a lovely weekend. We have really nice weather, mostly. There was some heat for a while, and there was some rain for a while. We had one good downpour. Just nice, though. You know, our back porch is shaded part of the day. And we could have today we won't have our coffee on the patio, but we usually do have coffee on the patio in the morning, and in the evening we have... sometimes we have some libations. Isn't that a great word?
It is. I was witness to a libation yesterday at the Griot Circle of Maryland kickoff to the National Association of Black Storytellers. 10th, well, let's see. Annual conference,
right,
and concerts, and every 10 years, this is the 40th year, and every 10 years, that National Association of Black Storytellers Conference comes to Baltimore. So the kickoff was yesterday with wonderful storytellers, and I'll tell you more about that.
Okay.
Into that.
So let's not forget Andy.
How could we?
I don't know, but we should. Andy Offit Irwin and his wonderful song Tarry Here, which tells everybody who's listening and hears that the words and the music, just a call to gather on the porch and listen to the storyteller. Just, every time I hear that, that's what I think. I think of somebody coming by and walking up and just deciding to sit on the porch steps and listen.
I do love that man. I have, besides my weekend, my Sunday with the Rio Circle of Maryland and listening to wonderful stories and wonderful drumming from Charles Watson, a young man who is an amazing drummer, who kept us grounded all through the festivities yesterday. I also worked in my garden for a number of hours, and that was peaceful and enjoyable.
Oh, that's good. I know you like doing that. And it's good that we have people like you, because we have people like me who would rather kick a rock down the street or something than work in the garden.
I did some of that. I have a lot of rocks in my garden. Yeah. So tell us about Speak.
Speak Stories.
Right up.
Speak Story Series, August 9th. And as a reminder, you can get all the information about Speak Story Series at speakstoryseries.com. And we still have 5 presentations until we close the 10th anniversary season here. And in August 9th, just 8 days away now, Carrie Sue Iva. And she connects people with languages, cultures, and curriculums in both English and Spanish for over 40 years. Performing in diverse venues, she is an award-winning storyteller, a Chautauqua scholar, and a national credentialed teaching artist. She's an advocate for the art of storytelling and arts education, and I know you have seen her perform or heard her perform. And I haven't, so I'm looking forward to that.
I haven't seen her in performance. I've seen her tell little snippets of stories during meetings on Zoom, because she's part of the Assist storytelling group that Sheila started.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in meetings with her and watched her advocate for storytellers who have fallen on hard times, and she's just a wonderful storyteller and very persuasive person, and has her ducks in a row.
Right. a bit of news about storytelling and listeners, and that we are not going to the National Storytelling Festival this year.
Yeah, I am not either.
Good. Well, see. So that side of the tent will be really light.
I'm sure they'll have some people.
They will have some people. We just made that decision. I've got stuff going on and with all kind of things going on. And decided it's best to stay around.
Did you just give the website for Speak?
speakstoryseries.com.
Okay, thank you.
And that will give you all the information about coming up. And it's just as a reminder, in case you've already gotten if you're a season ticket holder and you've already, don't bother looking at the information until the day of stuff. For a couple of months, we were doing a Tuesday and a Wednesday show. The Wednesday show in person, and the Tuesday show also on Zoom, and the Wednesday show not on Zoom. But that has changed as of last month, actually. A venue for in-person storytelling has been very difficult to lock down. The Opera House in Shepherdstown was supposed to be ready. And I know, it's not their fault. Equipment, funds, all kind of things have slowed down their project. So I think we thought it was going to be ready in January this year, then in March, and then in June or July. And now it may not be ready until the end of the year. So we're just doing by Zoom for the rest of the year. And there you go.
Okay. So, do you want to start us out with a story on the theme of unintended helpful Samaritans?
Yes. And I will, if you would like me to.
I would love you to.
And what I did was, this is interesting because I made a list of, I think I have a list of with 23 items. I just started from when I was a kid and thought, you know, who's been good to me? Who's been nice to me? Who's helped me out? And actually the very first person, I was going to say my kindergarten teacher, Sister Gerald, but she helped everybody out. So it wasn't special to me because she helped everybody out, and including she managed to teach the toughest kid in the class to really like school and not hold on to the door frame anymore when his father brought him for first day of school. I always remember that. A kid that grew up to be the absolute toughest guy in the neighborhood, a really good guy, strong, and who was also a defender of people who needed defending. You know, he didn't let anybody bully kids. And but my first picture of him was holding onto the door frame and Sister Gerald saying to his father, "You can go, he's fine. We're gonna do fine here." And the father, who was quite a brute of a man, who he had a meat store and a grocery store, looking like, how is this lady gonna handle this? But in no time at all, he wasn't even down the hall 10 steps before Daniel was in the room. I'm not sure what Sister Gerald did. I think she just put her hand on his shoulder and said, "It's time to go find a seat." And that's the way she was all the time. So she was a big influence on everybody in my family, because both my brothers had her in a class also. Anyway, but I made this list and all I got up to was my first year of teaching in public school, and I had 23 items. With that, I stopped last night, yesterday, over the weekend I was doing this. And I thought, if I wrote down a list of people who have helped me and been kind to me and nice to me up until my soon-to-be 81st year, I'll run out of paper. But I am going to continue with the list. I just stopped there because I thought, how many stories could I possibly remember? So I thought I would pick some that were really, what I considered to be nice. And I may have mentioned somebody before like this, but have great memories of, and when I was in sixth grade, I was not what you would call the nun's favorite all through elementary school. I often got in trouble, and part of that getting in trouble was, I would say things. I would say things like, "I don't believe that," just out loud in class. And that would get me in trouble. And in sixth grade, our principal was Sister Mary Christophine. And she was just an incredible person. And when I was in sixth grade, I probably got sent to the office about, I'd say once a month, maybe more often. And I've had that problem all my life. As an adult, I have learned to control it better. Although football helps out a lot, because I can say anything I want to the television about football. And I can scream at the players and the referees and the coaches. But Sister Christophine did a wonderful thing for me. Starting with the first time I went to the office, she knew my name, of course. The nuns always knew your name. I don't know how they did it. I sometimes think they could put something like with indelible ink that showed up only for their glasses, like, you know, on your tie or something. So they all do is look at you and there was your name glowing to them. But first time I went in, Sister Christopher said, "Stash, how are you today?" And I was surprised because not all the nuns would call you by your first name. Some would call you by your last name. Some would call you by your brother's name, stuff. But Sister Christopher said, and I said, "Oh, I'm fine, Sister. How are you?" And she said, "I'm fine, but I am so glad you're here because I have some things that you could really help me with." She handed me a stack of papers and she said, "Would you please put these in alphabetical order? And you could work right over at that desk." And so I went over to this table and I'm thinking, wow, when does the ruler come out? Because I had never been in her office before that. And I was expecting to really get it, be in trouble, but I wasn't. And so each time I ever went to the office because of, I would show up and she would always greet me like that. "Hi, Stosh, how are you? Having a good day or something?" And always would say, "I've got something for you to do over on the table. I'm so glad you came," you know? And she made it as if I was doing her a big favor. And that taught me a good lesson. It taught me a really good lesson that if you're going to get in trouble, at least do it in a place where you're not going to get in terrible trouble. Or, you know, if you're the person in charge, think about the troubled kid. Maybe the troubled kid really isn't that bad and all they need is a smile and, you know, a helping hand about something. So I always have had a very dear feeling for Sister Christopher. And she died within, I think, about 18 months of my being in that sixth grade. And that was very sad because she was, I think of her as the best administrative person I remember in a school, because she was always kind. And I can't say that about all the people that were, all the people in charge in schools, in any schools, you know, all the way up through even graduate school. So Sister Christopher was that good Samaritan on my travel through the halls of Holy Rosary School. And before I got too much older. When I was a freshman in high school, I was fortunate enough to have some soccer skills. I had played for a couple of years in elementary school for the church team, which we weren't very good, but I got to touch the ball a lot because most of the team wasn't very good. So they were glad not to touch the ball. It was one of the interesting things about young children. And when I was a freshman, I made the varsity team at Calvert Hall and I wound up lettering as a freshman, which was really special, to get a varsity letter. I was the first kid in my neighborhood to wear a varsity letter from a sport. And but there was a guy on the team named Gene, and I won't say his last name so that I don't tell, you know, something about might get him in trouble. But I don't know if he's still around or not. But I helped the kid. I knocked the kid down on the field and helped him up. And I just was ready. I was saying the word sorry about that. And Gene came over, grabbed me by the arm, pulled me away, and gave me a stern talking to. And this guy was one of the stars on the team. He was a great player, and he gave no quarter, which is a great saying, though it took me a long time to figure out what that meant. And he told me, "Don't ever say you're sorry. You didn't do anything wrong. You were playing the game. You knocked him down. Okay. It's all right if you offer him a hand because you don't want anybody not to be able to get off the ground. But you should just do that and walk away. because your job is to play the game. You want to talk to them after the game? Talk to them after the game, you know, and it's okay. But when you're on the field, you shouldn't be making friends or making apologies. And I thought about that a lot because I was a freshman on the team. There were a lot of large human beings on the team. We had a group of seniors, three Lithuanian guys who all looked as if they were fathers who had stolen uniforms and came and joined their sons on the field. These guys were all big. I was so small and because I had the ability to not get my legs kicked, my shins, when someone else would try to get the ball, I could get up in the air above the ball. And, you know, and because of that, one of the Lithuanian guys, Vytis Sarasaitis, gave me a nickname, which luckily didn't stick after that soccer season. It went away, which I'm glad of because all those seniors went away. But he called me Twinkle Toes. And, you know, that Twinkle Toes is not what you'd call the, you know, the tough guy nickname. But it fit well. And I never did get kicked in the shins because I was good at avoiding it by doing that. And so those guys were very nice to me. They joked with me a lot about that and about, you know, maybe I should take up ballet and things. But they made something that could have been mean into something that was fun and encouraged me. And that made a big difference. So there's two of my little stories about people in school helping out.
Oh, I thought you were going to give us all 23.
Oh, my goodness. It would take too long. No, I will say after you finish the story, I'll tell a couple more. But
okay.
No, I don't. Some of them are too long, crazy. And
Lauren, what's the storyteller's name?
Who begins? Mimi.
Yes. Talks about the list format. The list structure of a story, that you can create a story out of anything, including a list. And I've done that based on
your
suggestion. So I like that you have a list of 23.
That's a really good point. Yeah. As a teacher, my lesson plan often was a list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a list of what I'm going to doing. You know, what I'm going to do in class, where I'm going to go, chemistry lab or math, you know, which problem I was going to do and stuff like that. And I found it was really helpful. I made a list so that by a certain time, I would remind people of certain things like homework and things like that. So the list thing works real well.
I try to organize the radio, this radio show that way, but I'm so distractible that I quickly lose the list. And I often forget to put things on the list that are crucial.
Right now, I
want to remind our listeners that they're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org and our theme today on Monday, August 1st, is unintended helpful Samaritans. And I have a little story on that topic. This is a legend of the Blackfoot Nation that I found in Pleasant de Spain's book on multicultural stories, 33 Multicultural Tales to Tell by Pleasant de Spain. Published in 1993 by August House. The medicine wolf who came with the snow A village of Blackfoot Indians was moving from their summer to winter camp one year long, long ago. As they went, they were attacked by a band of Crow warriors, and several of the Blackfoot were killed. A young woman of the tribe, called Sits by the Door, was captured. She was tied to a horse and taken to the camp of the Crow along the Yellowstone River. Sits by the Door was made to do the hardest jobs, and if ever she complained, she was struck about the head and given no food to eat. The man who captured her tied her up at night and made her sleep next to his wife to ensure that she did not try to escape. The wife had a good heart and tried to show kindness to Sits by the Door. Although they spoke different tongues, they both understood some sign language. One day, the wife told Sits by the Door that the warriors had decided to kill her. They thought she was just too much trouble, and she had to escape that night. While her husband was sleeping soundly, the wife cut the rawhide thongs from Sits by the Door's hands and feet. She gave her a small bag of dried meat and a chip of firestone and told her to travel far and fast, for the warriors would surely try to recapture her in the morning. Sits by the Door ran and walked and ran again until the sun began to rise. Exhausted, she came upon a small cave, crawled inside, and fell asleep. She stayed hidden for 3 days. At last, the Crow warriors gave up the search. She was free. By this time, Sits by the Door's strength, as well as her food, was nearly gone. She began the long journey home with little more than a strong heart. Worse, an early snow began to fall, and she realized she was being trailed by a large gray wolf. Sits by the Door walked for 2 nights and a day through the intermittent snowfall, finding the going hard and beginning to despair of reaching her people. Toward morning on the second night, her strength finally left her, and she collapsed on the ground, close to a large outcropping. The ground was almost bare of snow in that space against the rocks, except for the remains of scrubby plants the wind had pushed against the rocks, creating a pile of scrub that made for a bit more shelter, for which she was grateful. This was a better than average place to die. But the wolf had followed well behind her, patiently waiting his moment. He approached her cautiously, sniffed at her hands and her neck. Sits by the Door could smell his unwashed fur and the stink of his breath. She was frightened, but she knew the wolf would spare her from a slow, suffering death. She prayed for a quick end to misery. To her amazement, the wolf did not sink his yellow teeth into her throat. Instead, he lay down beside her, keeping her warm as the snow continued to fall all around her. All through the night, he lay there, keeping her warm and safe. In the morning, he left, only to return a short time later, dragging a freshly killed buffalo calf. With the chip of firestone struck against rocks and the scrub for fuel, she was able to start a small fire, just enough to heat some of the meat. The wolf ate his portion raw. By the following day, she was ready to continue her journey. The wolf walked with her for the remainder of her journey home. And when she came into the Blackfoot camp, her people were overjoyed to see her and impressed with her new companion. She told them how the wolf had saved her life. "There is strong medicine between us. I call him Medicine Wolf." The people understood her story. They believed in the bond or medicine that can occur between an animal and a human. The council of elders decided the wolf could remain with the village and live with Sitz by the door. Even the camp dogs left the wolf in peace. He stayed with his human friend until she died many years later. Then he left the village and was never seen again.
Wow. Whoa, that is a really nice story.
Isn't that a nice shivery story?
Pardon?
A nice shivery story.
Shivery story. What's it? Shivery? I know that word, but
it's a little scary.
Oh, I see. Okay. You mean like shivery?
Yes. Didn't I say shivery?
You said shivery. Okay. But I've heard the word shivery.
Like chivalry?
No. I've heard the word shivery and I thought it meant something else.
Maybe it does. Yeah. Maybe it's Polish.
No, it's not Polish.
Okay. No.
There's no word in Polish that sounds like chivalry. You know, of course, I know the whole Polish language.
Yes, absolutely. Limitless.
I thought chivalry, actually, I thought that had to do with some kind of a celebration or, chivalry.
Sitting Shiva.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do some research on it because I think the chivalry, I really thought it was like some kind of celebration or a special thing. Hmm. And maybe it is, I don't know. Or maybe I just heard it differently. But no, that was, I like that story. It was only 6 minutes too.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have other things to talk about a little later on. I have some books I'm reading that I want you to know about, and I think our listeners will be interested in.
Okay, let's not forget that.
About that later.
So, since I had a school theme before, I'm going to jump up to college. When I was a sophomore in college, I was the oldest member of my class because I'd been in the Army for 3 years. And so I was 3 years ahead of them. It was interesting. At a reunion last year in October, I saw 28 of my classmates. We graduated in 1966. And they asked me to speak about how I got into college because I did not take any tests and I had help getting into college because of my uncle who was a priest. Anyway, I was studying chemistry and math. And as a sophomore and a chemistry major, you take organic chemistry. And the organic chemistry teacher at Mount St. Mary's then, we only had 725 males on the campus. There were no females except for a few people in the office. I think there were two ladies in the office, and there were a couple of nuns who did things around the campus. So it was all males, mostly. Father Gordon, his nickname was Father G. He had worked for a chemical company. He had found a couple of important things for this chemical company and actually was credited with having created a molecular substance that became very important to the company, and he gave it to the company. He never got any kind of royalties or anything like that. And shortly after that discovery, he left being a chemist and joined the priesthood. So, and Father G had an incredible reputation, a devastating reputation. If you wanted to go to medical school and you got a recommendation from Father G, from Father Gordon, you were in. Didn't matter where you wanted to go. That's how powerful this man's reputation was. He was up in years at this time, early 60s. He was, I'm sure he was in his 60s then, maybe even closer to 70. If you didn't do well in his class, you might as well forget applying to medical school because he would not give you a recommendation. And at first when I heard this, I thought it was a little bizarre. I wasn't used to higher level education. In my family, I was the first one to go to college. And so college things kind of seem strange to me. You know, now they don't seem as strange because the educational system is a real, real strange thing to navigate through. Well, beginning of my sophomore year, I had a girlfriend. I started having a girlfriend, a local girl. And years later, I found out why Father Gordon didn't seem to like her family very much. Because at one time he had mentioned something about those people down the road that you hang around with. Her family lived just at the edge of the campus, in fact, in a campus, in a college home. Anyway, the first semester of my sophomore year was a real disaster as far as chemistry was concerned. I loved the lectures. I did pay attention. I took good notes. But for some reason, I did not apply myself the way I should have. And the reason was because of having a girlfriend. I spent far too much time with the girlfriend and neglected my studies, especially the hardest study, which was organic chemistry. During the Christmas break, I got permission to stay on the campus because Dr. Thomas, who was my freshman chemistry teacher, actually kept giving me a small job that I got paid for being a lab assistant. And I told him I could do the repair work, which was on the balances we used, because I had watched the man who came in the first week in October, I believe it was, and did a couple of the balances they just needed a few things, you know, make sure that they were working properly. And I told him that I could do that, and I would be glad to do that if he would get permission for me to stay on the campus during the Christmas break. Back in the 60s, I don't know how it was on other campuses, but that was not that unusual. You know, I had a key to my room. I had no problem. I wound up not eat. There was no place to eat on campus. I got some meals in town and also at my girlfriend's house. But I was in real trouble. I was in danger of possibly failing organic chemistry. Father Gordon, as I mentioned, his nickname was Father G. And when he introduced himself, and I found out that this is the way he introduced himself always to new classes, he would say, "My name is Father Gordon, but everyone calls me Father G. I'm not really sure why," but he would raise his eyes to heaven and kind of nod and say thank you quietly, as if Father G was as close to God as could be. And I think he actually believed that because he ruled with an iron fist in the classroom, and he smoked 17 cigarettes during a lab one time. 17 cigarettes, one after the other. He would just light the new one off of the old one and throw the old one into the sink. And then at the end of the class, he would gather up all of the butts out of the sink and get rid of them. Smoking was not allowed in any of the classes. And he would remind us that. Remember, boys, smoking is not allowed in any classes here on this campus, as he lit a cigarette. But of course, no one was going to tell him not to do that. Anyway, it turned out that just before that Christmas break, Father Gordon became ill, and he was in the infirmary at the college. They had a very nice infirmary that if you were ill and it wasn't life-threatening, they would keep you in the infirmary instead of sending you to the hospital. And he was under the care of a nun who was a nurse nun who wore a white outfit. She was a very large human being, and she had a nickname, which I will never say, but about her being so large in this white outfit. I found a note. I found a note attached to my door, and it said, "Father Gordon is in the infirmary. He would like to see you this evening." So, when I finished working in a lab, working on the balances, I got cleaned up. And I went down to the infirmary, and the nun took me to the room where Father G was, and he was sitting up and said, "Come in, come in." So he said, "You know, you're in trouble in my class." And I said, "Yes, Father. I know you gave out grade slips last week, and I realize I'm in trouble." And he said, "You know, you're going to fail. And if you fail, you can't be a chemistry major. You can't fail a chemistry class and continue as a major. You might want to drop down and lower your sights in science and maybe study biology or something." And he laughed. He didn't think a whole lot of other sciences. He was a physical scientist. So anyway, he had a nice talk. He never did say the family name, but he talked around the fact that I often was seen leaving campus and walking down the road to go to the house down there, and got the message across to me that having a girlfriend and seeing her frequently during the week and the weekend, and not paying attention to studying was a sure way to screw up a chance to be in college. Anyway, he gave me a bit of advice, a reminder about how I should be studying. And the entire time I was waiting for the hammer to come down, because I had heard so many things about how he was ruthless to people in some ways when they weren't doing well in his class. And he said to me, I believe that you have enough friends and you probably came to school with enough determination to get a degree. So maybe you should reevaluate what you do during the week and on the weekends in place of studying for chemistry, and put chemistry in front. And he thanked me for coming in. Told me he wished me good luck, and I hope I had a good Christmas. And I left. Unbeknownst to me, he had made a contact with this the girl I was dating, with her mother, who he knew very well. She was a teacher in a high school. And he mentioned to her that he was concerned about one of his students and her daughter spending so much time together. Well, the woman who became my mother-in-law, the mother of my first wife, really had the hammer. She had me at the house for dinner the next night, and she and I and her daughter had this, I would say it was a round table discussion, except there was no discussion. We were two listeners, and she just laid down the law. It was interesting. I was 22 years old, going on 23, I guess. And she spoke to me and her daughter as if we were 13. Really, laid down the law. You will not see each other during the week. You will not do any homework sessions together during the week. And if your grades don't improve, maybe you won't be able to see each other at all. I can honestly say, in the Army, I was chewed out more than once by a sergeant, which I think anybody who's been in the Army for 3 years would say, yeah, that happens. And in playing sports, I had coaches, you know, really give me the devil for doing something, making a mistake. Or that. But because of her rules, and I didn't know then that she had had any contact with Father Gene. But because of that, we did behave. I did not see the girl during the week, and only saw her on the weekend for maybe 2 hours on Saturday and 2 hours on Sunday, and sometimes not that much. And incredibly, I raised my grade. I wound up not failing. I wound up not getting a poor grade. I wound up getting a B in the course, which was, and Father G told me at the end of the year, he was very proud of me because I had paid attention and had decided not to waste the money my father and I were spending on an education. And as much as there were people at that school who actually never said a good word about Father G, I left my sophomore year thinking that he was one of the best people I ever knew. Because instead of ranting and raving at me, and that he said he thought he saw, you know, the chance that I would be a good person and have a college degree and go on to do something worthwhile. And that encouragement from him, along with my future mother-in-law's rules, made a big difference. And at the end of that year, I did thank her very much for keeping us out of trouble and keeping me from making a bad mistake as far as possibly getting kicked out of the chemistry program. So thanks to Father G and to my first mother-in-law.
What a great story. I can just see all of that in my mind's eye.
Yeah. And I never told many of my classmates. I thought at the time, I remember, because I'd been in the military, because I'd played sports and stuff, I thought, I'm not going to mess with his reputation. I'm not going to tell anybody that he really does have a very soft side and doesn't yell. And that, and I admired him, and I admire him too today. But unfortunately, the very next year, or at the beginning of my senior year, Father G died. And of course, the entire community was very sad. The condolence notes that the college received from people all over the country, students that he had taught, many, many, many doctors that he had sent off to medical schools with his recommendation, and the chemical company that he had worked for even donated a large sum of money to the college in his name after his death. So here's to Father G.
Oh, wow. Well, now you're making me think about all the people that have helped me over the years. And I'm going to try to make my own list of 23.
Well, I'm sure my list will grow because I started teaching my first year of teaching in public school in 1970. Was a long time ago. And so I have a number of years of, I taught for 40 years, so I have a number of people who are influential with a lot of things that helped me out.
John, our radio manager, just sent us two chat messages. The first one, he's offering the word shimmery to replace shivery, as if that might be a word you were thinking of.
Mm-hmm. I saw that on the chat. No, that wasn't. It's shivery. I'm going to have to investigate it. I think it is a...
Okay.
I really think it is something about a dance or a celebration or something in somebody's culture. No, it's a shivery, honestly. That's the word, shivery. I'm not sure to spell.
Okay.
But I'm going to investigate it. So, I find out that I'm really wacky about something that I don't know what I'm talking about, then we can admit it on the radio.
Okay. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Did you also see the chat that says 17 cigarettes per class?
Yeah. No, I didn't.
Would be a definite killer.
That's what he died of. Father Gordon died of lung cancer, and he sometimes, if he was outside of class, he sometimes would hold court. That was the expression that people used, because he would sometimes just sit on the steps, and he attracted people to him, you know, like honey to bees. I mean, he was, if he came outside and sat, he would often have a folding chair near the building where his room was, and he would sit that outside near the steps and sit down, and in no time there would be five or six students near him sitting on the steps, sitting at his feet and just listening. And he told just wonderful, wonderful stories. And his stories were always fun. And sometimes they were scary about things that happened in the chemistry lab and shouldn't have happened because somebody wasn't paying attention. But it was worthwhile to go and sit near him. I didn't do that very often my first semester of sophomore year, but in my second semester, I did spend more time around him on purpose, because I found out instead of him being this tough old grouch who ruled with an iron fist, he was just a tough old grouch who had a good side.
Well, if you knew he was dying of lung cancer, that might have had something to do.
Oh, well, you know, people, other professors later, I spent a lot of time around Mount St. Mary's, and even after I graduated, and a lot of people talked about Father G, about how he had been, you know, fussed at by the president of the college, by the college board, you know, the guy, you know, grouping. And he just said, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. Even though he had a terrible hacking cough and everything, he just refused to give up his habit. And, you know, as we know now, and people, even then, people knew stuff. Smoking is a terrible addictive habit.
How old do you think he was?
I think he died in his 70s. And his funeral was, if you actually didn't know details and you were a stranger in that area, you know, from someplace around Emmitsburg, that you would have thought the Pope was visiting or something for his funeral. There was almost no place to park on the campus. And people wound up parking at the gym, which was a great walk from there to the main church. And then he was buried up on the mount at a cemetery above the college. And the police had blocked off the road to the mount, to the graveyard, because so many people had parked their cars there on that road, and there was no more room to go up. In fact, they had to have a police escort in front of the hearse that took his casket up to the graveyard, because the road was pretty much jammed with cars. And we all thought we were going to get a day off. The students, we actually did. We thought this is going to, you know, they'll probably give us Monday off because they had the funeral on a Sunday. And they didn't. We had classes the next day. With typical young men thinking, oh, this is terrible. Our professor died. Maybe they'll give us the day off.
Before we close, I just want to mention, I'm reading a book about cricket, and I wondered if you know anything about cricket. Is that an
interesting? I don't know anything about cricket, except it obviously takes a long time. Sometimes games go on and on and on and on, and they have a strange way of pitching the ball and of swinging a flat bat at the ball. I've never even watched a cricket match. I was going to once on TV, but it was, they said it would be on for hours if it's one match. And so I probably ought to do something about it and learn something about it, because it is a famous game played throughout the world because of England.
Well, I have a book for you that I want you to read so we can talk about it.
Okay. That'll be good.
This is what it says on the back cover. So this is a 1983 reprint of a 1963 book by a man named C.L.R. James, who grew up in Trinidad and was a pretty famous cricketer because he was an author. And he was, I guess now he's more famous as a historian, but he did have history playing cricket. This review on the back of the book says, "The most important sports book of our time," says Warren Sussman. "The sport is cricket, the scene, the colonial West Indies, and the commentator, the eloquent and always provocative C.L.R. James, who shows us how, in the rituals of performance and conflict on the field, we are watching not just prowess, but politics and psychology at play. Part memoir of a boyhood in a black colony by one of the founding fathers of African nationalism, part passionate celebration of an unexpected and unusual game. Beyond a Boundary," that's the title, "raises in a warm and witty voice serious questions about sports and society." Wow. 20-year-old classic. Now in its first American edition, a prophetic statement on the issues of race and sports today. I'm loving the book, and I don't know anything about cricket, but I am learning.
Oh, good. Well, I think you would like it. That's really good. That's neat. I look forward to it. I will like to borrow that from you.
All right. It's from my dad, just as fair warning.
Does that mean it has something on it that I'm going to catch? I'll all of a sudden become a guy going to union meetings and stuff?
No, I think my dad really enjoyed the book as well. It's marked up in places.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And be honest, I might not enjoy every book your father owned. However,
absolutely. I don't enjoy every book.
However, I'm sure if I read a number of books that your dad owned, I would become better educated.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ciolkowski.
Your co-hosts for the 5 p.m. Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging you, our listening community, to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. And if John is around, he can maybe tell us what's coming up next.
As usual, it's the blues
coming up.
On Mondays until 5 o'clock when you guys come up.
All right. No.